This is your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we're going to discuss the Heritage Foundation's expanding role in shaping the Trump administration's policies. Earlier this month, Donald Trump fired Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica McIntarfer, falsely accusing her of rigging jobs reports. He then replaced her with E.J. Antoni, chief economist at the Heritage Foundation, the think tank behind Project 2025, and a frequent guest on Steve Bannon's War Room podcast. According to the BBC, Antoni has called BLS statistics phony baloney and last year urged DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, to, quote, take a chainsaw to the BLS. In an interview with Fox, he said the jobs report, which includes the country's unemployment rate, the number of jobs created over the last month and other data, was unreliable. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the economy are two guests. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of several books, including It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, and The Big Cheat, How Donald Trump Fleeced America and Enriched Himself and His Family. David K. Johnston is founder of the nonprofit news service DC Report. Hi, David. Thanks so much for joining us again. Oh, David will join us in a few minutes. Chris Lehman is D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation and contributing editor at The Baffler. He was formerly editor of The Baffler and The New Republic and is author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Rose. Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, great to have you. So, Chris, are you in D.C. right now?
I am, yes.
So before we talk about the BLS, can you just tell us what it's like on the streets? And right before we went to air, we learned that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth signed an order authorizing the nearly 2,000 National Guard troops on the streets of D.C. to carry weapons if their mission requires it. So they have not been armed, but now he signed an order saying they can be armed.
Yeah, that's right. I should stipulate I'm actually in Silver Spring, which is the Maryland suburb just to the north of D.C., but I've been down to the district a couple of times since Trump's August 11th, basically declaration of siege here in the district. And it is, it's odd. Like I was sort of in the U Street corridor, which is a sort of nightlife hub. It's where the famous sandwich throwing incident occurred, which I guess would not happen probably with an armed National Guard on the receiving end. But yeah, the mood among DC residents is both angry and guarded. I would say, I think people really resent, as anyone would, I think, the descent of a dramatic armed police presence in their midst without any, you know, crime has actually been declining in the district over the last 2 years. So the whole pretext for this mobilization is a lie. And it is basically functioning, you know, because DC is effectively prevented from governing itself under congressional control. Congress approves the city's budget, overrides laws that the DC council and the electorate pass. So it's a ready plaything for an authoritarian regime to sort of say, okay, we're going to steamroll in and take over your police force. I think it's a very, you know, eerie, apprehensive moment. And I do think the escalation of, putting armed troops on the street is what an authoritarian regime does.
Well, and the scary thing is it really could get out of hand very quickly.
Well, I mean,
some scholars are saying if someone gets shot, we could have martial law in this country. I mean, I've been asking some of our guests in the last week about this. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is sort of terra incognita. And there are National Guards are summoned typically for emergencies like the LA riots in the 90s. But there is, you know, there is no emergency in Washington. Again, it's important to stipulate at the outset that the very terms under which this mobilization is occurring are a lie. So then the question is, what is the function here? It is to show a sort of unilateral exercise of state power that, you know, I am quite sure is just being prototyped for other cities, so that by next election day in 2026, you know, Philadelphia, Minneapolis, or
Oakland,
Detroit,
New York,
we'll see ICE agents in masks, you know, sort of patrolling voting lines. It's a very grim and ominous development.
Chris Lehman is DC Bureau Chief for The Nation. And now we would like to welcome David K. Johnston to the show, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter and author of many best-selling books. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Well, glad to be with you again, Rose.
Well, great to have you, David. Before we dive in and talk about the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we just got word in the last hour that Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth has signed an order authorizing National Guard troops in D.C. to carry weapons if their mission requires it. Scholars are really concerned, David, that if someone gets shot, we could have martial law. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm not only concerned about it, because of things like the Posse Comitatus law from right after the Civil War, but the handguns they have selected are a military version of a Sig Sauer pistol, which is well known for users, including police officers, saying, "I didn't pull the trigger and it went off anyway." They could have chosen a much more reliable sidearm. So this worries me greatly. And as Chris Lehman was pointing out, this is a legal, provocative, designed to intimidate action, and it's just the beginning of this. A number of military bases have received emails. I've seen a couple of them, basically telling them that you will soon have many DHS agents at your facility, many National Guard people sent there. You're to get Connex boxes. That's the shipping containers we all have seen that, you know, bring things here from China and elsewhere. But when the military has one and calls it a Connex box, it means it's full of weapons and ammunition. And you'll notice that the cities Trump has called out to, he's already taken action against for the military, L.A. and Washington, have women mayors who are persons of color. The others he's named, Detroit, Boston, et cetera, are also cities led by either women or people of color or both. They're not talking about taking action in cities with real crime problems, like, say, Jackson, Mississippi, where the crime rate is four times what it is in Washington, D.C. And when my wife and I were there in July, because we went to spend a week going to civil rights museums, we were warned by the people in our hotel that it wasn't safe at night to go out on the streets in the area near the area of Jackson where we were. That's not true in D.C. So this is intimidation, and it is the dictatorship continuing to consolidate power.
And Mississippi has sent troops to D.C.
Yes, right.
Right.
Irony is not dead.
David, you know, I want to ask you a bigger picture because you've been at this for a long time now. We had a professor on the show earlier this week, Kurt Wayland, who studies authoritarianism around the world. He said he did not think this would happen so fast. And then I was struck by what I heard from Masha Gessen on NPR. Masha Gessen is author of Surviving Autocracy, who said, it took Putin over a decade to consolidate autocratic rule, or put a different way, it took Putin over a decade to do as much as Trump has done in 7 months. So I wonder what your thoughts are, David.
Well, Donald Trump declared himself our dictator on February 26th. That's only 5 weeks into his second term. That's when he said, he who saves his nation violates no law. And they've been thinking about this for a long time. In the first administration, they wanted to do it. Donald very much wanted to be our dictator, but he didn't have the people with him. He didn't know how to do it. Now he's surrounded by zealots and acolytes who are loyal to him. He has no risk of any kind because his attorney general, Pam Bondi, the utterly corrupt Pam Bondi, is his puppet. So there's no risk to him that he will in any way be the subject to some law enforcement action. And the quicker you consolidate power, the easier time you will have than enacting the rest of your agenda, which he's hinted it means no more elections, possibly. You know, he said you won't have to vote again. Maybe it's not exactly what he meant. But make no mistake about it, Donald Trump, I've been warning people since at least, Rose, since at least 2011. I think I said it before that, but I can't find anything I wrote before then. Donald Trump believes he should be our dictator. He believes no one else should run the country. And look, the courts have by and large been very helpful to him. There's a number of places where they haven't gotten anywhere, but look at how the courts on things like the extortion racket he's running, the emoluments clause violations. What did the court say in the first term? You have no standing to sue. You have no right to bring a case over this matter. The article, section 3 of the 14th Amendment, et cetera. On specific actions, the courts have been pretty good. But on the broader things that grant him power, they have not. And, you know, I up until a few weeks ago, I was of the view that we would get through this. We would restore our democracy. I'm not certain about that anymore. I think there's now a significant, the less than half risk that we are going to lose our democracy and everyone listening to this will die under a dictatorship. We have got to respond and we have to have massive, larger public demonstrations. And we've got to get those Republicans who know better to stop being Quislings. And for those who don't know, Quisling was the collaborationist Norwegian dictator in World War II. When I was a five-year-old boy living on an orange ranch down in Orange, I knew what a Quisling was because my grandmother was Norwegian. The Republicans who are abandoning all their principles to bow down to Donald, they're Quislings. They are traitors to American freedom and democracy. And we got to peel some of those people off and get them to stand up.
Wow. Chris, what would you like to add? How do you see this moment, and did you expect things to move so quickly?
I see the moment almost exactly as David does. If anything, I'm sorry to report my view is grimmer. I think, you know, American democracy, I don't think we are functioning as a democracy any longer. And I feel like, you know, among other things, the notional opposition party, the Democrats, need to recalibrate across the board their strategies, because, you know, this, our constitutional system wasn't designed to accommodate a political party set out to undermine and destroy the institutional bulwarks of representative government, which is what is now happening. I was afraid that it would be rapid because, as David was saying earlier, this is sort of the MO for dictators seizing power. It's a shock and awe tactic. You keep people off balance. You keep, you know, the news cycle flooded with power grabs and demagogic actions and violence. And I think, I think we are in a very dire situation. And it was all, you know, sort of laid out in Project 2025. That is the Heritage Foundation's playbook, basically for consolidating power under an authoritarian executive and to institute an anti-democratic sort of Christian nationalist agenda, which is what's happening now.
And before we end, I want to ask you both what message you would send to listeners, because we opened the lines yesterday and people said it's pretty dark and they want to make sure that we talk about what people can do about this. But before we do that, since you talked about Project 2025, let's discuss the man that Trump has tapped to lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So he worked with the Heritage Foundation on Project 2025. And can you tell us more about the Bureau of Labor Statistics, Chris, for people who are not familiar with this department?
Sure. It is, branch of the executive branch that basically collates job data, also tracks the consumer price index, and, you know, is because of its centrality in sort of setting economic policy, it is traditionally a very nonpartisan, you know, technocratic operation. And in fact, you know, presidents are often, you know, upset by the Bureau's, you know, jobs numbers and stuff like this. But Trump, in dismissing, you know, Antony's predecessor, you know, again, said something that was just flatly untrue, that she was rigging the job numbers against him, that the labor economy was performing much better, et cetera, which is, you know, a very worrying cause to dismiss someone who was, by all accounts, a very professional and accomplished labor economist. And B, again, is part of this authoritarian playbook. You know, as George Orwell explained in 1984, the most important function of the party in that dystopian state was to get people to disbelieve the evidence of their own eyes. So Donald Trump wants a Bureau of Labor Statistics to cook up a prefab version of the economy where the job sector is doing much better than it actually is, where tariffs are not producing the inflationary spike we are now living through. It's also important to note that the consumer price index is absolutely critical in all kinds of economic policy, ranging from welfare and SNAP benefits to, you know, basic forecasting. And if you have someone who, you know, the other thing to note about Antony is he is stupendously bad at understanding basic economics. That is not a rhetorical exaggeration. And many, in point of fact, many conservative economists have come out against this nomination just on the simple grounds that he does not understand fundamental categories of economic analysis. And devotes most of his work to fatuous MAGA cheerleading, which is, of course, why he's been nominated. So this is very worrying, not only in terms of, you know, the economic press or the political press mostly just, you know, approaches these issues in terms of Fed watching and you know, whether jobs numbers will prompt Jerome Powell to lower interest rates per Trump's request. But in point of fact, you know, misleading or incorrect or false inflation numbers affect everyone. Like 108, by this is the BLS's own estimate, 108 million Americans receive benefits and income supports based on the consumer price index. So if Antony, who doesn't know what he's doing and is sort of dancing to the tune of MAGA, puts out false or misleading numbers, which is pretty much the mandate based on the history here, many, many Americans are going to suffer.
David, the New York Times reports that until Trump fired her, Erica McIntarfer was an economist with bipartisan support. Then July's report showed a weakening economy, and Trump accused her of rigging the numbers. The International Journalist Network put out a piece called "Why Journalists Must Fight for Credible Public Data" by Laura Zahmer. She writes, "The gravity of the decision by Trump to fire McIntarfer should not be underestimated. Some might view the firing as a minor incident. However, for those of us who come from countries where political interference in public data is or has been a constant for years, the firing signals an ominous turn for the United States." What are your thoughts on that firing, David, and what it means?
It is very bad for the country. First of all, business relies on the BLS data to make decisions. Are we going to invest? Are we going to expand? Are we going to lay people off? What's going to happen going forward? These numbers they produce are incredibly important. You can't rig these numbers. There are too many people involved, and there are protocols for what they do. You can reasonably argue about this, the way that they measure the change in television set prices reflect changes in quality, and is it the right right measure. But once they've announced their protocols, they rigorously follow them. And it is routine, by the way, to revise the numbers 1 month out and 2 months out. So this is absolutely disastrous for us. But this is what dictators do. I spent a week at the Chautauqua Institution studying autocracy and fascism. And each of the courses I took, taught by people who are experts in this field, was about how the use of the strings that are pulled and the levers that are used, and statistical agencies to you and I and most people are sound, you know, boring and, you know, it's just a bunch of numbers. One of the reasons we're as wealthy as a nation as we are is the quality of the statistics we have, and we should be refining and improving them, not using them politically. And little known fact, I haven't seen much reported, the current inflation rate in July for all consumer products, so it includes food and energy, is 3.1%. That's just a tad over the post-World War II average. But you know what the same inflation rate is measured in Canada? It's almost half of that, 1.7%. And that ought to say a lot to us about how Donald's tariff wars, his flip-flopping, where do you see flip-flopping applied to Donald? His utter ignorance about the most basic things. This is costing us money left and right as a society. The first fruits of the Trumponomics harvest are coming in, and they are very bitter, and they're going to get worse.
David, what are your thoughts about media coverage of this? Legacy media coverage.
Mostly I would fault the Washington Press Corps for not asking the tough questions and keep pushing them. And let's recognize that all this other stuff is all designed to draw attention away from the most, I believe, the single most important issue we face. And that is the president of the United States a child rapist, a frequent child rapist? And he can't survive if we get proof of it. We have billowing black smoke coming out of the White House. Things I've written about in my books and articles that suggest strongly that this would make sense. Statements Trump has made, like on the Howard Stern show. But we don't have absolute proof. If we had the Epstein files, we would either be able to have a definitive yes or no to that question. And so the reason that they want to hide it is Trump knows the definitive answer is going to be, yes, Donald Trump is a serial rapist. He really did rape an 14-year-old girl and tell her, as she's testified, you should be glad Donald Trump is taking your virginity instead of some incompetent 14-year-old boy.
David, I what's so interesting about what you're laying out there is Donald Trump's supporters are turning on him because of Epstein. And so
some of them,
but a lot of people are wondering, how did this become such a massive story again? And now he's doing what he can to crush it. How do you see this playing out?
Well, the single most important story that nobody has done, and I wish the New York Times would do it in particular, is a timeline that puts in, here are the authentic videos, because it's easy, you know, these days to fake videos and images. Here's the authentic videos and the authentic images, and here's the testimony this person gave and that person. Let's remember, there are more than two dozen women who claimed that Trump raped them. A number of the young women have said, we want this out there. You just redact our names and tell the stories of what happened. The government isn't talking to the victims, even though Justice Department policy says that they must. And so I think it's critically important that more and more coverage be focused on this. Focus on Jeffrey Epstein's financial records, because if he was not a Wall Street genius, he was not, he was running an extortion racket, then the trading records will show that. It'll be like the Madoff case. You'll find out the trading records show he wasn't trading and he wasn't issuing dividends to investors. We need to listen to the young women who were victims here. And keep that story going. It's absolutely crucial. And after all, who is the person who said we're going to make the Epstein files public as soon as I'm back in the White House? Donald Trump.
Right. And Ron Wyden, Senator Wyden, says an investigation needs to be held on the role of sanctioned Russian banks in the financing of Epstein's sex trafficking activities. We're going to do another show about that. Final thoughts from both of you. I mean, there's so much going on here. The nomination of Antoni will come before the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, most likely next month. Republicans have only a one-vote majority on the committee. Members include Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins. Collins faces a difficult re-election. What are your thoughts on this, Chris? Do you think that the members are going to follow orders and vote for Antoni? What are you hearing?
Well, that's certainly been the pattern. You'll recall that both Murkowski and Collins were sort of performatively wavering on the big, beautiful bill, the, you know, massive spending and taxation bill that Trump forced through Congress and predictably caved. This is what Susan Collins does. She will symbolically express concern and then fold like a cheap suit. So I'm not sanguine, even though, as I mentioned earlier, many conservative economists are opposed to this nomination and are hoping that the Senate will scotch it. And I do think, you know, you were saying what should voters do? I think one very good thing is to pressure your senators, which we in D.C. don't have, but to vote no on this appointment. It would be a good beginning. I think, you know, it's also important to note that the continuing resolution on the budget is up September 30th. Chuck Schumer, in my view, disastrously caved in the last time that deadline came up. And I think that this will be one of the last opportunities for Democrats to use leverage in this Congress to try to slow or stop this horrifying authoritarian takeover of our government. So I'm hopeful that, or I don't know if I'm hopeful, but I would also urge listeners to pressure your representatives in Congress to make sure that.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Chris Lehman is D.C. Bureau Chief for The Nation and author of The Money Cult. David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, author of many books, including The Big Cheat. Chris and David, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.